You've landed Inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Everyday innovators. Have you ever wondered why you sometimes feel like you were in one of those nightmares where you were running down a hallway faster and faster, yet the door you are trying to get to at the end continues to get further and further away? Please tell me I'm not the only one with that nightmare. I've had it so many times. Actually, I know other people have too. I think work actually sometimes feels like that too, which is why you will love today's podcast guest and conversation. But before we dig in, I want to share a little something from my new book, Innovation is Everybody's Business. I share this because for you as a podcast listener, I know you are the type of person that believes and invests in your own growth and development. So I want to give you a little validation that your mind is flexible. And as you listen to my podcast and all the other ones out there, your brain is actually busy adapting and changing with you. I think that's what we need to innovate. How cool is that, right? So let me read this for a second. Okay, here we go. I took a welding class, partially to live out my Flashdance dreams and partially to build something with my hands. I work on a computer all day, and the idea of actually physically creating something intrigued me. In class, we started simple and worked our way into more complex structures. So I ended up making a dragonfly sculpture that sits on my desk today. It's rough and clunky, and I may be the only one who can tell it's a dragonfly, but the class was worth a few hours of my time to learn a new skill. It was a fun exercise and fun using my mind in new and different ways. Have you ever, as an adult, decided to learn a new skill? Knitting, glass blowing, playing guitar? Did you notice how in doing so, you also learn new ways of thinking to master that skill? So that's exactly what a group of researchers found when they asked a group of 48 participants to learn how to juggle. Why juggling, you might ask? Because juggling is a complex motor skill that requires accurate bimanual arm movements, grasping, and visual tracking. So in non-research terms, it's a cross-functional skill that requires multiple senses to complete. So in this study, they visually mapped the white matter of the brain to better understand what happens when you learn a new skill. The white matter tissue contains millions of nerve fibers or axons that connect and talk to each other. I kind of envision it looking like the pictures of Earth from space at night with the lights across the cities connecting each other in beautiful patterns. It was previously believed, like my old mind believes, that the way our brains are wired is determined at birth and unchangeable. What they discovered proved the opposite. The brain is, in fact, able to create new connections, hence new patterns of thoughts and skills. In mapping the control group, they found changes in white matter that directly correlated to training periods. It's called neuroplasticity. Now, for humans, this is exciting, because if you believe you are one of those people who don't innovate, you can learn how to acquire that skill. And when, of course, I say acquire, I really mean take your innovative mind off sleeper mode and put it into action. All right. That's from the book, a little bit about the neuroscience behind innovation. It's so cool, right? But I bring this up because today's guest, Stephen Shapiro, is all about flexing and twisting and alternating your view, challenging assumptions, right? Specifically, the questions you ask. And that takes a flexible mind, the flexible mind we just talked about, right? So again, I share that from my book because it is proof that all of us can innovate and think differently and that our brains are plastic, right? They're willing to expand and change with us. And that's what it takes to ask those different questions as Stephen talks about. Let me tell you about Stephen. For over 20 years, Stephen Shapiro has presented his provocative strategies on innovation to audiences in 50 countries. During his 15-year tenure with a consulting firm, Accenture, he led a 20,000-person innovation practice. He's the author of 6 books, including his latest, Invisible Solutions, which is what we talk about in this podcast today. His personality poker system has been used around the world to create high-performing innovation teams. In 2015, he was inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame. So I've actually kind of tangentially known Stephen for some time now, and I can tell you firsthand, he is brilliant. And that brilliance, and I think his desire to help all of us innovate, shows up 100-fold in this interview. We dig into how to ask better questions, avoid assumptions. The challenge with brainstorms, and as he puts it, not avoiding the box or getting outside the box, but getting a new one. Why? Because it turns out constraints are good for innovation. He even shows us how. So his book has 25 lenses to help you ask better questions, innovate, and get to those strong, but often invisible solutions. So what do you say we take our flexible minds and apply it to this conversation? Let's do it. Steve, what a pleasure to have you back. It is so great to connect with you. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, so I know you. We've kind of have some mutual overlap, not just in our topic, but also in our friends and our circles. So, but for the people who don't know you, what's one thing they'd be surprised to learn about you?
I think there's probably two things. One is that when I was growing up, I wanted to be a game show host. Chuck Harris, the host of the Gong Show, was sort of my... It's true. I mean, I loved watching the Gong Show, not so much for the acts, but for Chuck Barris. And I thought, that's what I want to be. And then the other thing, which, you know, I've been in the innovation space for 25 years. A lot of people don't realize that I am an engineer by education, and I think like an engineer, and I bring an engineering approach to innovation. So I think those are two things a lot of people don't know about me.
I mean, I have so many questions about the game show, but we will save that for the next time I run into you in person, because, oh my gosh, that's amazing. It's funny because I was watching Don't Judge Me, but I was cleaning the other day and I was watching The Price is Right. It was just on in the background. And I was enthralled with Drew Carey and how he was getting people to talk. I just thought it was fascinating, totally fascinating. So I kind of get it. But I want to go to your engineering background for a minute, because you kind of say it jokingly, like it's, you know, so different than what I do today, but there's, and I'm sure you found this, there's really so much benefit to having these two different, I don't know, educations, perspectives, and bringing those together. I think oftentimes, right, we get so myopic in our world and we get so deep in our expertise, but you're kind of bringing duality to the world, which is kind of cool.
Well, that's my goal. I mean, I think too often we think of innovation as this right brain creative endeavor, when in fact, it also needs that left brain analytical aspect to it. And I think when we bring the two together, we then get much better innovation.
Yeah. I mean, the research has shown it's actually a whole brain experience. So the whole left right brain thing has actually totally been debunked, because it's not actually how it works. So let's dig into your book. I'm going to do something a little bit different. I actually wanted to read something from the inside jacket, because I thought, after as I was doing my research, I thought this set up the premise for the entire book and really our conversation so well. So let me read that for everybody real quickly. And here's what it said, and I'm kind of pulling from a longer paragraph, but unprecedented access to infinite solutions has led us to realize that having all the answers is not the answer. From innovation teams to creativity experts to crowdsourcing, we've turned from one source to another, spending endless cycles pursuing piecemeal solutions to each challenge we face. What if your organization had an effective and systematic approach to deal with any problem? To find better solutions, you need to first ask better questions. The questions you ask determine which solutions you'll see and which will remain hidden. So I thought that was brilliant, not just because it kind of, I was nodding my head and thinking, yes, oh my gosh, we keep following the shiny ball of like, what's the next solution that's going to solve all our problems? But also your comment about piecemeal. Why do you think we're so hung up on looking for piecemeal solutions? And I guess the second part of that is, what's the impact of that?
Well, I think what happens is we're always looking for the silver bullet. We're looking for the quick answer. And so it is easier for, I'm stepping back for just a second. You know, a lot of times we use the expression think outside the box as a shorthand for innovation. Well, it makes no sense, because it's not the way the brain is operating. The brain actually likes constraints. And so the reason why we tend to think in a piecemeal fashion is because the brain actually does love constraints. We want the box. We crave the box. The problem is we're in the wrong box. So it is just a natural expression of the way the brain is wired to operate this way. And so boxes aren't bad, but if we're in the wrong box, we'll never get the right answer. And to me, the key is to actually start taking what we think is the opportunity, what we think is the problem or issue, and start to look at it through different perspectives.
You know, it's funny about outside the box. I think the other challenge I see with our clients is that if we say to them, I don't say it because I can't stand that phrase, but if you say to them, think outside the box, the brain automatically goes, but I have a box I have to deal with. So what do you want me to do with that box? Because I can't just walk away from it. And if I walk away from it and come up with an idea way over here, right, then I got to bring it back and it doesn't fit into the box that I have. Although I like what you're saying about kind of finding a different box. So in finding a different box, why do questions have such a powerful impact on innovation?
Well, I think of the question as the box. And now sometimes questions are explicit, sometimes they're implicit. Sometimes we're in a box, we don't know we're in a box. And sometimes we do, and we just don't know how to change it. And so for me, the key is to recognize that when we're trying to find solutions, sometimes the best way to find a solution is to not focus on the solution, but rather it's to step back and say, what am I really working on? What is the goal, objective, and can I reframe the problem? So one of the book actually starts off with a quote from Mark Twain. And one of the lines, one of the expressions that he uses in that quote is basically we need to put everything into a mental kaleidoscope. And to me, that is such a brilliant metaphor for the way that I see the world. Is we have a problem we're trying to solve. It's our box. But maybe we make so many assumptions that we can't see it's a box. So how do we challenge our assumptions? And the key way to challenge our assumptions is through that mental kaleidoscope. How do I take the problem I'm working on and twist it and turn it and look at it from different angles to now all of a sudden reveal solutions that were previously hidden but now become obvious because we've just shifted the question?
So I want to dig a little bit deeper in something you said quickly, but I think is important, which is that explicit versus implicit questions or things in front of you. Talk more about that, because I think the explicit ones maybe are a little bit easier to identify, but the implicit ones really can constrain you, but they're hard to see.
Absolutely. I mean, the explicit ones tend to be sometimes they're cultural norms inside of an organization that everybody agrees to. They could be procedures, or they could be even regulations and government policies. So those are the explicit ones. And we sometimes fight them, but look, they're still a box. It's the implicit ones, the ones that are based on assumptions. And the reason why these are so dangerous is because our past experiences often at a subconscious level, at an implicit level, drive some of the decisions we make in the future.
Right.
So the key is to recognize that what worked for us in the past probably will not work for us in the future, given the world is changing pretty quickly. And so we need to uncover those assumptions, those implicit beliefs that we've had, and bring them to the surface so that we can challenge them and move forward in a different direction.
Do you find we just spend all our time on the obvious ones? And not just because they're maybe easier, although maybe that's the wrong way to say it. I don't know, you tell me, but just also because they're right in front of us and we can deal with it, it's tangible. And the implicit ones take, I would assume, right? They take a little more time and energy to A, figure it out, because to your point, right, they're so invisible sometimes that we don't even realize they're there.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that the brain is actually wired for survival, not innovation. Its primary function is survival. And so what happens is the brain creates neural pathways to things that we've thought about a lot or think about for a long time. And so our past becomes our future. That is just a natural expression, because what we did in the past didn't kill us. Therefore, it's safe right to continue to do it again. So it's hard because it's not how we're wired. We aren't wired to challenge norms. We're actually wired to continue norms because those are the safest path forward. So it does take time to actually sort of interject some thinking to question the question.
You know, the stat I read was, in my research, was 96% of what we think is the same as it was yesterday. Like in fact, I've said that quote multiple times, so maybe that's a great example of I'm just saying the same thing over and over again. I want to ask you about the questions themselves, because I 100% buy into this. Like you got to think differently about the questions, right? It's your starting point. But I think a lot of us are asking terrible or the wrong questions without even realizing it. It feels good. It sounds good. It seems like the right thing. Maybe it's on the surface. What are some of the red flags that I'm asking the wrong or terrible questions? I don't even know if that's the right way to ask the question, but I think you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, and I don't think that there's necessarily any wrong or terrible questions per se. They just might not give you the results that you want. And I think it comes down to a variety of different things. And I'll start off with one and we can go from there.
Yeah.
One is, I call it the Goldilocks principle. And the Goldilocks principle is based on Goldilocks and the Three Bears. She goes into a house, three beds, one's too soft, one's too hard, one's just right. And the too soft and the too hard describe the way we tend to ask questions. So the too soft part is we ask questions that are too abstract. Hey, how do I improve the organization? So if you asked your employees, how can I improve the organization? How can we improve productivity? How can we increase revenues? You will probably get, depending on the size of your organization, hundreds or thousands of ideas, of which the odds are all over the place. Most of them very low value. Most of them irrelevant. And in fact, based on every personal experience and every study I've read, less than 1% of ideas that are submitted to suggestion boxes actually create value. It's typically even less than 0.1%. So that's the part of it, is we ask these big, broad, abstract questions. We don't take the time to deconstruct them into something more meaningful. On the flip side, we ask the questions that are too hard. They're too specific. They're too detailed. Mm-hmm. And they're either very narrowly defined, and that maybe it's all about my industry or my function or my discipline, or they're actually solutions that are masquerading as questions. And that one is really insidious.
Ooh, can you give me an example?
Well, sure. I mean, so I remember some work that was being done by NASA, and it started off with they wanted to find a way. This is back in the days of manned spacecraft, and they're getting back to that. They wanted to take a washing machine from Earth and bring it up into space. So they ran a challenge called the Zero Gravity Laundry System Challenge. And what was really interesting about this is the assumption was that we were to take a washing machine that we use here on Earth and bring it up into space. The problem was we need gravity. And in an area of zero gravity, washing machines, the water just floats all over the place.
Right.
So they ran this challenge called the Zero Gravity Laundry System Challenge, which assumed a solution. It assumed that our Maytag washer is going to be sent up into space, when in fact, maybe the different question was, how do we get clothes clean? And that's not a solution, that's the outcome. So washing machine was the solution. The outcome was getting clothes clean. And I'll just riff on that one a little bit more, because then you take it to the next step and say, how do we get clothes clean, to how do we keep clothes clean? And that demonstrates the power of just changing one word in a problem statement, because getting clothes clean means cleaning fluids, whereas getting clothes clean or keeping clothes clean means it's now a material science problem. Hmm. One word in a problem statement totally affects the way that we see the world.
That's really interesting. I really hadn't thought about the idea that solutions masquerading as questions. And that's not just about leaving off the question mark. That really is about how you phrase the question. So that's the Goldilocks principle. Were there others? I just want to make sure I'm not rushing to the next question.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons. Yeah. I think the other one is that we make just so many assumptions. We make so many assumptions about the way the world operates. And we, you know, and there's a reason for this. So again, it comes back to survival. So there's two things that are happening, which are both bad from an innovation perspective. The first one is we tend to come up with solutions quickly based on our past experiences.
Yeah.
And the second thing is we tend to move very quickly in the direction of that thought. So if you go back to, you know, the old days when there might be a big, furry, huge animal with fangs and teeth and is growling at you, you don't sit there and analyze and say, well, let's see, is that a saber-toothed cat or not? No, you get the heck out of there and you start running.
That's called survival of the fittest right there.
that's survival of the smartest. Just get out of there. And, you know, so, but here's the problem is that might have been a good strategy back then, but today, if you run quickly, the odds are you're running in the wrong direction and you're moving away from the possible and best solution. And so we need to just recognize that our first solution is certainly not going to be the best one. Our first question is probably not going to be the best one. And we need to at least take a little bit of time to be able to make sure we're moving in the right direction before we start running.
So let's talk about that and kind of get brass tacks on that, because I appreciate what you said earlier about we're wired for survival. So I've got questions, I've got potential opportunities or solutions I want to pursue, but to your point, maybe they're not the right ones, or we haven't taken the time to really sit in that long enough to go in the right direction and not run in the wrong direction. How do I get there? How do I rewire my brain, my team's brain, to get to the questions and the solutions that are actually going to put us in the right direction?
I think the first step is to just recognize that we ask bad questions, and in asking bad questions, we're going to get bad solutions. If you're asking the wrong question, I don't care how much time, money, energy, resources, or people you throw at the problem. If you're asking the wrong question, you will never get the right answer. But we spend so much time on the solutions and never really enough on the question. So the first step is just to put a pause button. Whatever you're working on, just recognize there probably is a different and potentially better way to frame the problem that will either yield different solutions or, in some cases, yield the same types of solutions, but we're going to find them faster. So I think that really is the first step. And when we combine that with the fact that we have to challenge our assumptions, that's why I created the book, is the 25 lenses in the book are really just that mental kaleidoscope that allows you to challenge your assumptions by helping you use a practical tool to reframe.
I'm curious, in writing the book, Invisible Solutions, anything that you kind of uncovered that surprised you is like, oh, this is a challenge we have, or a way to get over that challenge?
I think the thing which probably surprised me the most was, you know, I've always believed that people want to change in terms of organizations. They want to innovate. They want to embrace change. And there was a study which I uncovered during my research for the book, where, and we don't, won't get into the details of it, but basically it was a researcher at Cornell University who asked executives in companies, do you embrace change? Do you want innovation? Do you need creativity? And every single leader, every single executive, without fail, said, yes, we need it, we want it, we embrace it, we must have it. They then used a technique called the implicit association test. And this is a really fascinating test. It's one of the few tests out there that can test our implicit beliefs, like what we truly believe. And it does this through correlations. So what they did was they correlated words with change, creativity, and innovation. So is creativity good or is it bad? And it really tests what we truly believe at our deepest subconscious levels. And the thing which was interesting is at the end of the day, even though everybody explicitly said, yes, we want change, implicitly what they truly believed in the three words that most highly correlated with their true beliefs were agony, pain, and vomit.
Wow.
And so people don't want change. And it makes sense when you think about it, because change is risky. It's ambiguous. But at the same time, it creates complications.
So I just, for our listeners, I want to say, I mean, we'll put this all in the show notes, but I want to say the full name of the book, and then I've got some questions, more questions for you. Shocking. So the name is Invisible Solutions, 25 Lenses That Reframe and Help Solve Difficult Business Problems. So just want to make sure I said that out loud, because it's a phenomenal book. I've had a chance to peek in it. So for all of you out there, go get it. I think this is going to help, as Steve is talking about, reframe how we think about the work that we do. I'm curious, because you work with a lot of leaders. When they think about, I don't know if motivating is the right word, but getting their teams to think differently and to start question their questions and their assumptions, what kind of challenges do they face, and what kind of advice do you have for those out there dealing with that? Because it can't be just one person, right? It's not just the person at the top doing it.
No, absolutely not. And in fact, you know, I think one of the mistakes that organizations make is that they think that their leaders have to have all the answers. And to me, having the answers is not the answer. Instead, what we want is good leaders create other leaders. And the way good leaders create other leaders is by asking others questions that help everyone else ask better questions. And so once you start doing that, now you've basically taken this mindset of looking at the world through the lens of this mental kaleidoscope, and you bring it to every person in the organization, you now have opened up a whole new set of opportunities for the organization. And what's interesting, you know, earlier you're sort of joking about survival of the fittest, but actually it's survival of the adaptable. And, you know, one of the things which is really cool is when you use this mindset of questioning and assumption busting and all of that, an organization becomes much more adaptable, because the past does not become your future.
You know, it was interesting. I'd love to get your perspective on this. I was in a meeting recently where we were planning something, and it was like groupthink had taken over, right? And we were all headed in the other, in a specific direction. And at one moment I just piped in and said, hey, I wonder if we think about this differently and consider this. And it wasn't because I thought we should completely shift gears. I just wanted to poke the bear a little bit and see if we could just strengthen our thinking and, you know, kind of question if what we were all agreeing to so quickly was the right direction for us. And it turned out we made a little bit of a pivot because of it. And I'm not saying that because, like, look at me, I poked the bear, but just that I found this incredible resistance in the room for about 3 minutes where it was like time stood still and I could hear the clock ticking and you could see people's wheels almost coming to a halt and then having to shift gears. How do you think about getting people over that mental hurdle of, I'm going to go from just, to your point, right, survival to innovation? Hopefully that made sense. That experience, as you were talking, I started thinking about, wow, that was just a moment of exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think what you described also highlights the value of an outside perspective. An outside perspective doesn't have to necessarily be a consultant, but it could be somebody outside your industry. It could be somebody that you bring in that sees the world differently than you do. And you know, as I said, people don't like to change. You're absolutely right. And therefore, I think it's important before, you know, we spend so much time on content, but not enough time on context. And it's why when I work with a company, we spend a lot of time on context first. So people understand why these types of things happen, why the brain is wired to ask bad questions, the impact of these bad questions. And that's to me the key thing is providing context before we go into the content. That I find helps a lot, but you're right. People don't look, everybody's that groupthink, everybody's going, and it's sometimes hard to break that.
You know, in doing my recon for this interview, I was watching some of your LinkedIn videos and one of them was this awesome story of baggage claim. I'll just leave it at that. Hopefully you know what I'm getting at.
I do indeed.
Yeah. So to me, that was a great example of what we're talking about. Will you share that? Because I think that is one of kind of the stories that I've heard you tell that I think is brilliant.
So I'll tell a short version of the story. And the cool thing with this story is we could actually spend the entire podcast talking about it because it really is that robust and rich. Basically, the short version of the story is airport here in the US, passengers are complaining it took too long for the bags to get to baggage claim. So they did some analysis, found that it took on average 15 to 20 minutes for the bags to get from the plane to the baggage carousel. So they decided to solve the problem. How can we speed up the bags?
Right.
And they spent a ton of money on faster conveyor belts, more baggage handlers, newer technology.
All the obvious.
All the obvious things. And they got it from 15 to 20 minutes down to 8 to 10 minutes. Woo, popping the champagne.
That actually is impressive.
50% improvement is extremely impressive.
Yeah.
So they were declaring success prematurely. Because when they asked passengers what their biggest complaint still was, it was still baggage claim. And right. You know how this works, Tamara. There's a point of diminishing returns in any investment. Yeah. If it took that much time, money, or energy to get it to 8 minutes, to get it to 7, 6, or 5, it's not going to happen.
Right.
Then they had an epiphany. It took the bags 8 to 10 minutes to get from the plane to the baggage carousel. But at this particular airport, it only took the passengers 1 to 3 minutes to get from the plane to the baggage carousel. So instead of speeding up the bags, they decided to slow down the passengers and they literally reconfigured the airport so that it would take on average 8 to 10 minutes for the passengers to get from the plane to the baggage carousel. They get to the baggage carousel, their bags are waiting, people are celebrating. And you know, that to me just, it just shows you though that we could, if we spend our lives trying to speed up bags, we're not going to think to slow down passengers and we can change two words. And this is what I love about this example is we go so many different places with it. I just want just a little bit longer on is we could change two words in a statement and get a completely different range of solutions. So really the problem they were trying to solve, even though they said it was speeding up the bags, it was about wait time. How can we reduce wait time? Mm. And it sounds like the same as the speed of the bags, but speed of the passengers, but it's not. Then you change two words in it. How do we reduce wait time to how do we improve the wait experience? Just think about that for a moment. Changing those two words now opens up a completely new avenue of not just different solutions, which is about making the wait experience better, but different places to look. As you know, I live in Orlando, Florida. People pay $100 a day to wait in line at Disney and Universal Studios because it's fun.
Yeah.
So how do we learn from what they're doing? We can play with this for a while, but it just shows you that we started off with speeding up the bags, but it went from speeding up the bags to slowing down passengers to reducing wait time to improving the wait experience. And we could go on for an hour with different variations. And in just a matter of minutes, I demonstrated the power of changing the question because each of those yielded fundamentally different solutions.
So there's, you're right. We could probably spend a whole hour just on that story and deconstructing, although I think what you just said summed it up so well. And I love this kind of idea that it's exactly what you were saying earlier, I think, with the Goldilocks. Like it was too expansive or too restrictive, right? And what you're saying and the questions that you were asking are really somewhere in that middle, that sweet spot of giving direction, but giving people room to play as well. And you're right, like experience, I start to think about what does Disney do? What does Zappos do? What does Amazon do? But when I think about improvement, right, I think about incremental. I think about a little bit better, and a little bit better, to your point, doesn't get you the customer satisfaction ratings you're actually looking for.
Right, exactly. And I think the key, you know, like I love how you pulled in Zappos and all these others is, look, sometimes the best solutions, and I would argue in most cases, the best solutions aren't going to come from your industry or your area of expertise.
Yeah.
So like with the baggage claim example, you know, who else has you wait and it's not too torturous? Well, it's like Uber.
Southwest.
Or Lyft. Southwest. I mean, so when you're waiting, what can we do to distract you? What can we do? So, you know, I know if I'm waiting for an Uber, I'm glued to the phone watching that teeny weeny little car move closer and closer and closer. And somehow it gives me it's a game. It feels like sad. In fact, that would be a really cool thing is if they gamified it.
Yeah, it's like a game. I love it. It's so cool. I'd be like the winner of that game right there. Those of us in airports all the time, wouldn't we, Steve? We'd be like, I'm on this. I'm going to win.
I think so. So, but it shows you, look, sometimes solutions come from everywhere. And we don't take enough time to ask better questions. And we also don't take enough time to look elsewhere for better solutions.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in looking elsewhere and saying, how do I apply this to my world? And I think for a couple reasons. One is, to your point, right, there's other people doing it well or that have solved similar challenges. So why wouldn't we learn from them? But also, I think, to put it very simply, we're holistic beings. So my experience with Uber or Zappos or Disney or whatever it is, my local coffee shop, my expectation that translates to baggage claim, even though it has nothing, one has nothing to do with the other. So, you know, we're humans, right? We connect all the dots. And I'm sitting in baggage claim. I'm pissed off because my bags are 30 seconds behind me. Well, I don't understand where at Starbucks, like right after I order, my coffee's there. So why can't I get my bags? I know they're two different things, but that's how we think, right? Like, we're not confining it to United baggage claim versus American baggage claim.
Right. And like you said, we're not even comparing it to baggage claim. And if I have something delivered, you know, I have Amazon Prime. If it doesn't show up in 2 days and I buy it from someone, I'm probably not going to buy it from you. So,
right.
And like when we moved to Florida, I expected all of my belongings, my whole house and everything to show up in Florida 2 days later, and or at least know where the heck they were. But we create these expectations based on our experiences with different companies, even in different industries. And everybody has to keep on raising their game.
Well, I think it's one of my clients who's in customer service said to me, you're only as good as your customer's last experience, which I thought was brilliantly said. And I just think you created a whole new business, which is moving by Amazon Prime.
Ah, there you go.
Nail it. Nailed it. Right. Here, my next question might sound a little bit naive, but it's percolating in my brain. So I want to ask. So let's say I've started, to your point, I've paused, I've recognized, okay, we may not be asking the right questions. We're making all these assumptions. Let's pause and let's get to better questions. How do I know when I've actually gotten to the right questions or the better questions versus, you know, I could see this being an endless game going down the rabbit hole too and kind of letting analysis paralysis kick in. So how do I know when I get there?
Yeah, that in some respects is the ultimate question, and it's a hard one to answer. But I would say that typically you know you have the right answer when the solutions become apparent. Now, sometimes if they're too apparent, let me step back for a second. It depends on how you're going to solve it, because there's a lot of different ways you can solve a problem. You can have a problem or opportunity you're working on, and you can have a small team focused on it. You can crowdsource it. So, you know, we have a variety of different methods, and we need to make sure that the question we're asking suits the method. So, for example, if we're going to use crowdsourcing, we need to be ultra careful. And by the way, crowdsourcing just means asking a lot of people for their solutions to the problem. If we're crowdsourcing, we have to be extra careful in the level of abstraction of the question.
Right.
Because if we ask a crowd, how can we improve the business? Or as in the case of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion, where they were trying to stop the flow of oil, they got 123,000 submissions in just a few weeks, of which none of them had anything to do with the final solution, and only 12 of the 123,000 were thought to maybe have some value. That's typical. So if we're going to do crowdsourcing, our level of abstraction has to be lower, because otherwise we create a lot of noise. If it's a team of people that are working on it, then it's really going to be more the speed of being able to find a solution. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all answer to this question. It's really something which you learn through experience. And after a while, and here's the crazy thing. When people use the 25 lenses from the book, at first it is torturously painful. It is difficult. But then when people start doing it, even just for a short amount of time, it becomes easier and easier and easier. It's like any kind of muscle, and you do it, you get better at it, and then things become obvious. And so there's an art and science to all of this, but the art comes by applying the science, and then things become apparent after the practice.
Well, I think there's another layer of advice, Steve, that you just gave that's really important about it, you know, starting out hard and frustrating and annoying and getting easier, is I think both at the individual and at the team level, that recognizing that it's, you know, just because you decide that you're going to take this approach and get to those better questions, that it's going to take time for you to be able to do it well and for your team to do it well, and not to get frustrated when after the first team meeting, you still feel like you're not quite where you should be.
Absolutely. I mean, it's if it were easy, first of all, everyone would be doing it. But also, second of all, easy tends to mean that it's past-based. So if you're doing a brainstorming session and people are just coming up with ideas and ideas and ideas, I absolutely 100% guarantee you that everything they've come up with is something that somebody has thought of previously. It is something which someone has done in the past, or it is just an obvious answer. When it takes a little more effort, that is typically a sign that you're moving in the right direction, because now we're challenging our assumptions, we're challenging the past, and we're developing solutions that aren't the obvious ones. And again, it comes back to those constraints. I do an exercise with my clients, which powerfully demonstrates that when we have the right constraints, things become easier, but it takes a while to figure out what the right constraints are. And so it's just a process that people learn, they become great at it, and it transforms organizations.
Will you give me an example of that? Because if I'm listening, I'm aside from being the host, but if I'm out there listening in an organization, I'm thinking, ooh, I have a lot of constraints. How do I do that?
Well, the constraints, again, there's good constraints and not so good constraints. And so I'm not saying every constraint is something you want. We want to challenge them. But I also believe that we have to recognize that we can't change everything. So I work with a lot of regulated companies, whether it's a financial services company or government or even military. There are a lot of regulations, and they're not, look, as a person on an innovation team, you're not going to go change the government regulations. Other people may be working on that. That's not your job. And everybody wants to fight it. Yeah, it's out of your control, and everybody wants to fight it. But no, let's embrace it. Let's try to figure out how do we work with what we have. And I think that's just a natural thing. So here's the exercise that I do with my clients, short version of it. I get people into a group, I have them imagine they have a brick in their hand, they go back and forth, they have 30 seconds to come up with uses of a brick. And they will come up with whatever obvious solutions there are, like use it as a paperweight, as a doorstop. If the brick has holes in it, maybe they use it as a pencil holder. And so they come up with a lot of, it's easy. They come up with a lot of uses. Then I have them do the same exercise, but this time they have 30 seconds to use a brick for a particular context. So for example, what are all the ways you could use a brick on the body? And it takes a little more thought, but they start now coming up with things like, okay, well, I could use it to pump up my biceps, or if I have rough skin, I could use it as loofah to exfoliate, or I could put it on my head to improve my balance. And what people find is even though it's not easier, the solutions they develop are much, much
stronger
more creative,
and better. Yeah.
And they're stronger and relevant. So it comes back to context. But context creates a cognitive dissonance. It creates a little more work on the brain, but it creates more value in the ultimate result.
You know, I think what you're talking about here is really important, because I think that's part of the challenge that teams have when they go to innovate or try to shift their thinking, is that, you know, they're thrown into a room or an exercise where it's like, go be innovative without any of the constraints or the realities that face. Kind of goes back to the box conversation we were having in the beginning. And I think there's that, like, you know, filter on their brain that's like, this is never going to work because of XYZ constraints anyway, right? Even if they don't verbalize it, that's kind of in the back of a lot of people's brains. But what you're saying really gives them an approach to not fight those constraints or let them be the elephants in the room, but actually embrace them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, when we come to brainstorming, I think there are several mistakes we make when we brainstorm. The first one is we tend to spend more time on ideas rather than questions.
Yeah.
So Einstein reputedly said, if I had an hour to save the world, I'd spend 59 minutes defining the problem, 1 minute finding solutions. And from my experience, most organizations are spending 60 minutes solving problems that either aren't important or they haven't been well framed. So the first step always has to be the question. The second step is to recognize we have to have the right people in the room. We tend to only bring people from, if it's a marketing problem, we only bring marketing people in. Well, that's ridiculous. So as we talked about before, we need salespeople, manufacturing people, legal people, people outside your company, vendors, partners. And then the next thing is to avoid something you talked about before, which was the group thing.
Yeah.
If I'm having people, we've gone through the process, we've got the right people in the room, we've got a good question. We don't say, okay, how do we solve this? And we don't ask everybody to just throw out their ideas, but we have each person do it individually. So if you have 30 people in a room, now you've got 30 different points of light that now we can start converging on, rather than one person says something and everybody else just sort of leaps in that direction.
The other thing with that too, I think, is it, when we do that, when it becomes a verbal sparring game, you know, first of all, to your point, right? Like the leader in the room speaks first and then everyone says, yes, it's natural. We want to support the leader. We want to, you know, be seen by the leader, all that stuff, or whoever the most vocal is in the room. It also lets people like me suck up the air because I think out loud and I'm all about the verbal, right? It doesn't include the introverts, but I think the bigger impact coming out of that is we end up debating people, not ideas, versus you letting people do it individually and then kind of looking at all the ideas or all the nuggets that we have. And I think when we debate people, we get too personal and even the best ideas get shot down because it doesn't become about the idea, it becomes about the person.
I love that perspective. I love that perspective. And to build on that, one of the other things which you want to do, whether it's a brainstorming session or a crowdsourcing session or anything, is when you define the problem, the next thing you want to do is define the evaluation criteria.
Right. Ahead of time, right?
Ahead of time.
Yeah.
Because it allows you to be objective. The one of the ways that suggestion boxes fail is that every idea has to be evaluated against its own merit because there's no objective criteria. Whereas when we have a well-framed problem, we will get sponsors, owners, resources, funding, evaluation criteria, and evaluators up front so that once we get a solution that objectively meets that criteria, we have everything lined up to move forward. And it just totally, I mean, we found that when companies apply the approach that I'm talking about, they got a minimum of a tenfold improvement on their innovation ROI over traditional methods because we've eliminated all the waste in the system. As an engineer, I want to eliminate the waste in any process, especially the innovation process.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So the thing with brainstorms, they're fascinating. And I think you're right. I think we spend way too much going right to solution. Like, here's the problem, go. Versus trying to really pull apart and twist, as you said, and think differently about the question, and maybe even spend a painfully amount of time there before we even get to solutions. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, though, with that is, you know, I think getting people together is brilliant and necessary, but, you know, there's another 39 hours in the work week that we're doing the work, right? Our sleeves are rolled up and we're in it. And one of the things that I love about your approach and the questions is that it allows me or gives me a framework to apply that innovative mindset and tool, not just in brainstorms. And don't you think that's so important that it's that innovation doesn't just happen at that 3 p.m. brainstorm with the scented markers and the blank easel pad?
I do love the scented markers.
But I do. Well, they're like corporate crack. Watermelon's my favorite. I'm not going to lie.
So, but you know, you're so spot on with that because we tend to think of innovation as an event.
Yeah.
It happens when somebody decides to do it. It happens in a brainstorming session. It might happen when we run a crowdsourcing campaign, whatever it might be, but it is an event. And the reality is we want to move from this event mindset to a continual process to ultimately a system mindset. And when we move through those three levels, now we create this organic type of innovation. Innovation is not, I mean, there's this perception that innovation is done by the privileged creative few who sit on high mountains,
yes,
wearing long white robes and handing down the gospel for the future. And that's definitely not innovation. Innovation is done by everyone everywhere, because if we look at innovation through the lens of asking better questions and finding better solutions, well, then everyone does that every day, everywhere, in warehousing, in marketing, in customer service, in call centers. We're all doing some form of innovation. We're all doing some form of change on a continual basis. And that is the key, is you can't have it come from some central group, some central meeting. It has to be brought down to everyone inside the organization.
Well, I could not agree more. I mean, that is the premise of everything we do over here at Launch Street with Everyday Innovators and the assessment. And I love the way you said that about, like, it's manufacturing, it's distribution, it's all those things. Because really, for businesses to, I think, compete in today's world, that innovation has to get out of the silos and those. And I think we confuse, and it's very natural to do so, genius with creativity or innovation. So we look at, you know, Elon Musk and Steve Jobs and J.K. Rowling and Beyonce, whoever, right? We're like, oh, if only I could be like them. But the reality is that they are innovative, but we're all innovative, right? And the difference is like, I guess part of the difference is their impact on the world, but also there's some genius in there too, and they're not actually the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we all innovate. We just innovate in different ways. Yes. Some of us are very good at the analytical aspects, and you know, creativity and innovation aren't the same thing. So creativity, yes, tends to be that genius that you were talking about, that inspiration, that spark. But the problem with most people who fall into that category, you know, certainly not the examples you use, but other people, is they confuse the novelty with value. Mm. Novelty is not value.
Right.
Now, the people who are analytical are going to help us figure out what creates value. So it doesn't start with the idea. It actually starts with a question. And the question has to start with data, information, whatever approaches we use in order to make sure we're solving the right problems the right way. And that's so critical. And so when I wrote this book, it wasn't for the creative people, those geniuses as you would describe them. It really is for the analytical people, the everyday people.
The rest
people
of us.
Who don't think. The rest of us, because I think we all have that creative potential, that innovation mindset, but we just sometimes need a little spark and a little tool to help us with that. And the 25 lenses are designed to do exactly that.
Well, that's the other thing I really appreciate about kind of your work in the book is I think, you know, I think you had said in the beginning about like innovation being this mandate, right? That we're all like, you need it. It has to happen. We all agree in the surveys. It's a top priority, top skill, but we're not then given the tools to figure out how to do it, or at least unlock that part of us. And that's where a lot of it, I think, falls short. So to have 25 lenses in this book really gives you a myriad of ways to actually put it to action, which is, I think, again, where a lot of it falls short.
And that was my goal. I wanted, even though this is a book, it's based on a tool I developed a decade ago. And so the tool is actually embedded in the book. And then we built other digital tools to support it. But I wanted to give people the power to reframe. So for example, if you're going back to the Goldilocks principle, if you're asking a question that is too soft, too abstract, too broad, well, we have five lenses that are specifically designed to help you bring it down to earth, whether it's the leverage lens, which is all around how do we figure out what the leverage point? What's the one factor? What's the one thing, if we focused on it, would create the greatest value? And we provide insights on how to do that with examples. Or the deconstruct lens, which says, okay, maybe we don't know what the leverage point is, but what are the different parts? Are they parts, like parts of a car? Are they segments of customers? Or are they steps of a process? But they're still parts. And anytime we deconstruct something, we reduce the abstraction and have a better chance of solving. So I just wanted to create something that would allow people who haven't had the tools in the past to very quickly and powerfully reframe problems to find better solutions.
It's fantastic. So where can people go to learn more, get the book, connect with you?
So to learn more about the book is invisiblesolutionsbook.com. That's the best place. And from there, you'll find me and find everything else that I do and even find some things that we've done with some digital tools to support the book.
Very cool. So Steve, what's your final piece of advice for everyday innovators on Launch Street?
I think I would say my best advice is one of the lenses. One of the lenses is the performance paradox. And the performance paradox basically says that paradoxically, sometimes the best way to achieve a goal is to not focus on the goal. And I think the same thing is true with problem solving and innovation, is sometimes the best way to find a solution is to not focus on the solution, but instead step back, hit the pause button, even just briefly, and just say, what am I really working on here? What's the real goal? What's the objective? What's the outcome? And spend just even a few minutes just taking the time to really question your questions. That will unleash a whole new range of opportunities in a very powerful way.
I love it. I feel like that applies to all of life too. So I think that's a great thing to end on. So Steve, thank you so much for joining me. The book is phenomenal. Go out and get it, everyone on Launch Street. You'll get a lot out of it. So Steve, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.